Welcome, everyone. Welcome to the London School of Economics. My name is Savas Verdis from LSE Cities, and I'll be your moderator for this evening's lecture. It's a wonderful pleasure for me to welcome Amalia Zeppu and Jeff Mulligan to the LSE. I would also like to welcome the participants of the Executive Masters in Cities, as well as the Cities program students who will be visiting Athens in a couple of weeks' time. So the homework starts here. Amalia's work may be familiar to a lot of you. She was instrumental in setting up Synathina in 2013, which has become a key reference point of how cities can nurture social innovation. Synathina was awarded the Bloomberg Mayor's Challenge Award in 2014, and it was at the center of why the city of Athens was named the European City of Innovation in 2018. Amalia is an anthropologist who trained at the LSE, so welcome back, Amalia, and was until recently the deputy mayor for civil affairs in the city of Athens. And LSE Cities is very lucky to host her this year as the Bloomberg Visiting Fellow in Government Innovation. Jeff Mulligan has recently been appointed Professor of Collective Intelligence, Public Policy, and Social Innovation at University College London. This is indeed a long title, but it's also unsurprising because of his influence in each of these three domains for over 20 years. Jeff is one of the leading authorities around social innovation. Through his diverse roles in central government in this country, as director of Demos, as director of the Young Foundation, his numerous books, including a recent one aptly called Social Innovation, which was published last year, and most recently in his role as the CEO of Nesta, which he only recently stepped down. So where does social innovation happen? This is one of the questions that has preoccupied both Amalia and Jeff for some time. Despite all of the progress in the field of social innovation, we often still have very anti-social pictures of innovation, where social challenges are addressed through formal, often closed policy channels, universities or garages. But as we know, some of the most radical ideas have stemmed from social movements and collaborations addressing social needs that are not met by the market or the state. And it's this complex web of relations between the different actors in the social innovation space which we want to test tonight through the story of Athens and the personal story of Amalia, who is leading these efforts locally. All the different diverse groups that came up with solutions, I think there is nearly 4,000 and counting, to address very diverse challenges from extreme poverty in the city, the refugee crisis, to abandoned buildings in the city center and the western parts of the city. So we'll be looking at questions of how Athens was able to scale some of these initiatives through the Synathina program in the midst of a deep austerity, which was brought to the country for over a decade, and also how the city and Amalia engage with these groups. What is the role of the municipality in nurturing this social innovation space? The format for this evening's lecture is as follows. Amalia will speak from here for 30 minutes. Jeff will reply immediately for 10 minutes. I will then moderate a discussion between the two speakers for 20 minutes, and then we'll have another 20 minutes for Q&A at the end. This is a recorded lecture, so if you want to ask a Q&A, please speak clearly on the microphone, say who you are, unless you want to remain anonymous, and keep your questions short, if possible. That's it. Could you now all please welcome to the podium Amalia Zeppu?
Thank you very much, Savas, and thank you, LSE Cities, for organizing this public lecture. I would also like to thank the LSE because this is it's a very important place for me, LSE. This is where I studied social anthropology 30 years ago, And social anthropology has really become the way I make sense of things around me since then. After anthropology, I studied documentary making. I was inspired by the late Professor Peter Loizos, who screened ethnographic films every Tuesday evening when I was here. I made documentaries as a producer and filmmaker for almost 20 years, until I started doing what I'm going to talk about today. What I'm talking about today has three things. The one part is really the personal, my own personal story, how I started thinking about this platform and what community groups and community activities meant for me, and how I came to myself to be part of this activist, let's say, movement. The second part is about my role as vice mayor in the municipality, testing the extent to which the administration could adopt such a platform and a mechanism. And the last part is more about the achievements, but also the questions about its future. I'm going to start the story with this slide, which is a slide for people that don't know this. People are cursing the parliament. This is a photo that was taken, I think, in 2011. With this slide, I'm going to tell you how I moved in 2007 in a neighborhood near the center of Athens with my family and my three teenage kids. The crisis was already appearing in that the city was abandoned, and you could see garbage piling up and a lot of problems unaddressed. So I put the camera on the side and decided to kind of take care of the neighborhood myself. I cleaned up the garbage, I moved the garbage bin to a better location, I started planting trees and flowers in the abandoned plot. I helped the Turkish-speaking neighbor with their papers. I did door-to-door recycling teaching with the cardboard. And that happened in a period for 1 or 2 years. I was very conscious at the time that I had not called the authorities to come and do it themselves, because I knew that they wouldn't come. There were periods they wouldn't even answer the phone, or you couldn't find them. I didn't turn to the locally elected district representatives, who seemed to be sinking in interminable discussions of party politics. And I didn't either turn to the more traditional autonomous communities, some anarchists, some more radical, that existed already in Athens. I was enjoying, and I was asking myself, why am I enjoying this so much? A kind of provocative efficiency in remaining solitary and wordless by doing that. And as I continued doing more and more of those activities, I realized there were other people like me doing exactly the same thing, and the number of those people was increasing. And the similarity was not only in the way we were doing those activities, but also in the type of activities. The type of activities that started appearing were had to do with a new range of things, not only helping homeless or picking up garbage, but also caring about the urban environment in a new way. For example, lighting a dark street, or designing playgrounds, livening up abandoned or closed arcades in the center of the city, as well as guided tours, which I thought were very important, very telling about this new relationship with the city. Guided tours for visitors and tourists that were showing Athens in a different way, outside of the official rhetoric of the Parthenon and the ancient and classical Greece, but would take people to Muslim Athens, Jewish Athens, the neighborhoods that people didn't know about, and people also feeling proud not only for the rich neoclassical buildings of the center, but of the slightly shabby but very communal 4- and 5-story apartment blocks. And so also a new type of identity, let's say, and pride for the city was kind of emerging in that context. This is a kiosk that was beside the municipality, belongs to the municipality, and it had at that time this graffiti which says, "Action replaces tears." So besides this slightly provocative, wordless, but positive and efficient attitude, let's say, of these activities, there was also another side of this activity. The activity, that type of activity, appeared like an antidote to depression for a lot of people, for personal depression, but also as a need, like there is a Greek expression that says, "I want to take my hands in my life in my own hands," that you could hear at that time. And I think that it really expressed very clearly the need for empirical experience of one's own environment and future. And by doing those small-scale activities in the city, one would regain a little bit of that feeling that they, unlike the atmosphere and unlike what one would see around them, one would feel that at least there is this territory I can control and I can feel I can also inspire and lead in some way. So with that in mind, and seeing that these numbers were increasing in people doing such things, I decided to pitch the idea to the mayor, saying that, well, here you are, you have this invaluable knowledge of people doing stuff that seem to be needs of the city. Why don't we create a mechanism to understand what this is, to collect it, to see it, and to maybe to learn to collaborate with it? And municipalities should not only be places where people call for their problems, but maybe a place that can also collect solutions from the city. And I was very lucky because Mayor Kaminis was really had the right profile to have the audacity to say, okay, come on board and let's try and do this. He was an independent politician before that and the Ombudsman of Greece for 15 years before he became mayor in 2010. The other lucky thing of that year was that Bloomberg Philanthropies were launching this competition, Mayor's Challenge, which in the process of its application taught me a lot of things about what I was trying to do. I mean, it gave you the training, even the submission process gave you the training to kind of think what this machine would be, this Synathina platform. By the way, Synathina is the beginning of an ancient Greek proverb, Synathina ke hirakini, which translates God helps those that help themselves. The God in this particular case is the goddess Athena, who is the protector of Athens. And we won the Mayor's Challenge. Among 155 cities, we won one of the five Mayor's Challenge awards that came with 1 million. The other lucky thing of that year was that in the elections of 14, Mayor Kaminis asked me to be a candidate, and I was elected. So got into the city council, and that gave him the possibility to make me vice mayor. But until then, I had really never been in politics or never was a member of any party. Still, I'm not a member of any party. Next challenge was this. So we came up with this naive idea that, you know, you can draw on a piece of paper democracy. You know, once you draw it well, you can implement it right. So this was the Synathina idea, which basically and briefly had four steps. You collect activities. Actually, you ask people to upload their own activities on the municipality platform. You then try to connect them between them. You make people know each other. You connect them to the services. You connect them to sponsors. then you sieve this pool of activities that bring impact in the city. You sieve them by evaluating which are actually worth scaling up, which should be brought to the mayor as a priority of the city, like a thermostat, a platform that becomes a thermostat for the city, a thermostat of priorities, according to what people do for the city, not what they say about the city. And of course, the ultimate ambition was to incorporate this knowledge and upgrade and update the completely outdated and downgraded services of the municipality. So apart from the online platform, there was also the kiosk that I showed you earlier. We gave it to community groups that painted it and used it as a place that they could use for free, booking it on a calendar on their own and using it. So online, offline, that was basically the first kind of drawing. And the pins on this is the municipality of Athens with its seven districts. Each district has 15 elected members of the council, of the local council. The pins are the activities of those groups. Today there are 4,000 activities, 400 community groups. But at that moment, it seemed to be two completely different populations, the elected people and those creative, let's say, grassroots, informal individuals or groups of people did not come together. It was like impossible to put them around, to get them to know, to do things together. So we decided, of course, there was huge suspicion. I'm saying it lightly, but you can imagine the suspicion and also on the part of the city officials and the people of the municipality, great antagonism. So we decided to have one activity in one of those districts that would bring them together. And the activity was to find the use for this beautiful market building that used to be squatted for many years. The mayor had found European funds to upgrade it, and they did. They repainted it, etc. But they didn't know what it could become. The municipality, which still was in debt in 2015, and its city officials had shrunk from 12,000 to 6,000, and due to austerity measures, we couldn't hire new ones, had no capacity, neither the money nor the capacity to manage this building. And nobody from the municipality really knew what to do with it. So we said, okay, let's open a really wide open consultation, also to break area that had a lot of political strife earlier, quite poor, badly hit from the crisis, a lot of shops were closed. Let's open it and ask people what they wanted to become. So we collected 470 ideas, which were not so much about the ideas, but about putting these people together, not behind a questionnaire and a survey, but really an open-air game that lasted a whole weekend with workshops, events, and artists playing, to really break the ice and really show that most people actually wanted similar things. It took 3 years to actually launch this market in the vision that was expressed in those 470 ideas, because it had many levels of resistance all the way. There was this resistance from the locally elected, who could not understand how we could kind of give back the municipality to people that were, among which were some of the old squatters. We gave the municipality without rent, but against some proven positive impact in the neighborhood, re-aliven the neighborhood, open shops, do educational workshops, music, as you see here, cultural events, and a lot of services, social services. It took 3 years really to shift this expectation that, no, the municipality has to have it all ready for you, and the people and the inhabitants of the neighborhood would just be the passive recipients of this idea, that they had to be part of it. And in fact, we gave it to the bid gained. We had 17 proposals. One won it, Impact Hub of Athens. And they are running it still today. Talking about resistance, in the meantime, we did a lot of meetings between, not exactly meetings, workshops like this one, where we would put the city officials on one side, the bureaucrats, and some leaders of community groups on the other. We called it Adhocracy Loves Bureaucracy. And it was, even though at the time you couldn't see the direct the outcome of these very funny kind of meetings and discussions, I think it did break the ice. They did talk openly about prejudices. They did talk openly about the fear of competition, that, you know, some were afraid that the activists would take their jobs in the municipality. Some of the community leaders understood very clearly why bureaucracy is so incredibly important. So this was to show how this idea of bringing this new culture inside the municipality, not only the people, but the way by which we did that, was a very slow process. And we were lucky because the term was 5 years long. It is usually 4 years long, municipality terms, for the mayor in Athens, but that particular time, from 2014, we had 5 years in front of us, so we had the time for this maturity to occur. Now I'm going to talk about the way this model expanded and was repeated in many other areas and sectors of the municipality. This is a picture from the open schools. The open schools were the idea, and what happened was to open school buildings after school hours and make them community spaces. That was an experiment piloted in 25 schools in Athens that literally became very rich community spaces, open every day, even on weekends, from 3 p.m. to 9 p.m., gathering ideas, knowledge, teachings, and activities of the neighborhood. So it was 25, I used to think of them like as lighthouses in the city, where community was really kind of helped to be developed. There is a recent book I'm just reading now called Palaces for the People, which talks about how important it is to create social infrastructure. Social infrastructure is when the city helps to create and build places of such gathering. And this was a very good example of one of that. So the same model was behind it. Now, where did we get the money for those replicated projects, and quite experimental? It wasn't municipality money. The money for most of them, apart from the Sinathina, who had gotten its 1 million from Bloomberg Philanthropies, was from another foundation called Stavros Niarchos Foundation, who gave 10 million euro to Athens and 10 million to Thessaloniki in 2015 at the capital controls. So it was in the periphery, and those projects were kind of given to the municipality because they couldn't, because outside the municipality did not have the flexibility really to experiment at that level. Another example, I'm not going to open the refugee issue, but there was this other project called Curing the Limbo. That was, again, money from the European Commission from one of its recent initiatives called Urban Innovative Actions. The European Commission gives to the municipalities money to experiment solutions for topics such as the integration of refugees. The integration of refugees in this pilot project was proposed and designed to take its basis from the Sinathina platform, like the open schools with the communities, but this time to process an integration which would connect refugees with activities and community groups. And so the process of learning the language, finding a house, finding a job would be all along bonds and relationships created with the people that are active in the social sphere, in the public sphere. Again, activity became the way by which people that were stranded with no activity in limbo for months, if not years, either in camps or in temporary flats. It was a way to get them out of this inactivity. And this inactivity was not only theirs. It also concerned at the time, still now, the huge number of unemployed. So activity, again, comes as a trigger. To develop the mechanics, as we said, of belonging. Here we thought a lot, and maybe we could discuss this, about the notion of belonging and how the subjective experience of feeling you belong somewhere, not so much, because people might feel at home even though they do not have a job or do not know the language yet. This was an area that we were very interested in creating. So this is the constellation. There were more than 20 of such projects in the city of Athens with the same kind of, the same shape. The municipalities at the center orchestrating these projects, but with funding usually coming from an external source, with a university very often, most often, very close. I mean, this is very important also for LSE. Someone was asking me, you know, why are people, why should universities collaborate with the public domain? Well, they are incredibly important people because they help develop projects and design them that way. So we called it constellation at the beginning because it was fragmented. Each of us had its platform. Each of us had our own networks. And the next slide is a slide with which we actually won the award of being nominated Capital of Innovation. Because in a way, I think we articulated as a city that the municipality really was a failed system that could not work unless it kind of collaborated with the capacity of its city, whether it would be business or university or these community groups that brought their knowledge about things. And really, governance exists in those rings, in those spiral rings around the municipality. But the municipality on its own doesn't seem to really be able to address the complexity of today's world the way it's been, you know, the way it is. I think that if we won that award, it's because that Athens could actually articulate this sentence that, you know, we are a failed system, and even though we are not a city, we were not a city that is rich and powerful like other cities, we were capable in certain occasions and in those satellite projects of the municipality to embrace the compassionate populations of the city. So this is the distance traveled from the two pictures that I showed you. And thank you.
Okay, well, thank you, Amélie. Unfortunately, I have no pretty pictures at all. But I was, you may not remember this, I was actually one of the judges on the Bloomberg Award. So, yeah, I demand my commission. And one of the reasons, well, there were quite a few reasons why Athens won. One was the ideas, but I think also that the context. And you slightly underplayed that, but Greece in the early years of the last decade, GDP fell by how much? 40%?
Yeah.
I mean, unprecedented in recent European history in terms of the scale of the crisis, the disruption, the unemployment. And so what I wanted to maybe spend a few minutes on is the relationship between bad things and good things. When do bad events perhaps open up new possibilities? Because that was in a way what we as the judges were sort of keen on exploring with the platform. Now, in some ways, there is a great history of cataclysms or problems accelerating human progress. Many wars actually lead to new rights and welfare states and so on out of a crisis. In this city, you know, one of the most important events which ever happened was the year in the mid-19th century when the River Thames became so disgusting and so smelly that Parliament had to stop functioning. And that led to the building of the sewers, dramatic advances in public health, and so on. So there's this sort of weird pattern where often you need a pressure, you need a crisis, perhaps to see and do things which you should have done anyway. And more recently, that's been very clear with social innovation. So, 10 years before Athens, when Argentina had its big crisis, that led to an extraordinary flourishing of community projects and complementary currencies because the mainstream economy had retreated and people just had to fill that space themselves. They have to fall back on their social capital, on their family. If you can't get a job in the formal economy, you have to sort of revert to the informal economy and so on. And I think what's interesting is that in those moments of crisis, you actually see the city in a different way. You see its latent capacities and potentials, which are probably invisible most of the time when people are, you know, the economy is functioning, people have jobs, etc., etc. And there's a sort of weird sense sometimes of, in that crisis, of people reclaiming their own city. So again, just think of London. The time people probably felt most an ownership of London was in the Blitz, when bombs were falling and people had to, you know, come together, volunteer, act in a quite different way in response to crisis. And so this idea of action replacing tears certainly makes sense, but is easier perhaps in a moment of crisis. And then the question is, how can you distill what the crisis reveals into something more permanent or something which actually allows a step forward? And I think one of the really interesting things happening now is we have new technological tools which allow you to organize in a crisis in a different way. How many people here are familiar with things like Ushahidi? You know, the new technological platforms which have allowed really the world to respond to humanitarian disasters, floods and famines in quite new ways, because you can much more quickly see where there's available housing for refugees, where there are food stocks, organize money, etc., and allow society to self-organize, often much more efficiently than the state can do, using essentially network technologies. And what I'd like to open up is some of the other ways the Synathena approach may be opening up what could become a new normal. So one example, which I don't think you touched on, is care for the elderly. So one of the other projects which got an award that year from Barcelona was one of many initiatives around the world trying to use platforms to mobilize care and compassion and help and neighborliness for the thousands or often millions of relatively frail elderly who are often very isolated, don't have their families around, they have all sorts of conditions. How do you not just think of them as a medical problem, but as a human being? and mobilize often, you know, the willingness of their neighbors to do a few good deeds, drive them to hospital, get them some food and so on. And there's a lot of experiment happening there. Nowhere, I think, has quite sort of got it, but essentially it's very like Thin Athena. It's trying to think of the city as a platform which can mobilize latent, otherwise wasted energies to complement the formal system. The other examples which are perhaps closer are the many trying to rethink democracy and problem solving in a platform way. One of the pioneers there's been Iceland and Reykjavik, which has now for at least 10 years had its platform where people can propose ideas, can vote on money allocations, and that's become fairly normal. Other cities like Madrid with Decidem have experimented with similar kinds of platforms where, again, you, just as you've done, you know, try to make it easy for people to generate ideas, to comment on ideas, to prioritize alongside the bureaucrats and the elected officials. Britain, sadly, has been a little bit behind on all of that. Now, all of those bring to the surface the tensions you describe of who actually represents the community. Is it the elected, democratically elected politicians, usually in parties, or is it the community groups? And they both claim so competing authorities, often hate each other, often conflict, but I think in you know, well-run cities, they find a way to work together and accommodate each other. And so in these kind of projects, I think we see a different vision of a smart city, almost an opposite one to the hardware-driven, sort of technology-driven view of the smart city is all about, you know, clever lampposts, to one which actually is able to organize itself and mobilize the intelligence of citizens. And there are quite a few cities around the world trying to do this. I mentioned the ones in Spain, there's mayors in places like Malmo, Seoul in Korea, trying to rethink the city administration as a platform. And lots of little projects which kind of exemplify it. Here in London, the matched crowdfunding project of the GLA is quite an interesting one where, you know, community groups can you know, try to take over an empty building like that, and they get some money from the GLA if they can raise money from the community, and it creates a sort of dynamic where you're not just looking up to the municipality to provide money. We've had now 20, 30 years of kind of guerrilla gardens and pop-up urban farms and all those sort of things. And I was this time last week in Helsinki, which pioneered Restaurant Day. Some of you may know, you know, where they just said one day a year anyone can be a restaurant. And I think that spread to, you know, dozens of cities. But all of them are about, you know, allowing the people in a city to reclaim ownership and through action to avoid the tears. Now, as you said, this creates big challenges for the bureaucrats and the system. And this is perhaps, you know, a key thing to focus on for EMC, etc. So just a few, just to mention. In what you described, it was really interesting how external money, philanthropic money, creates the space for experiment and the new, which the official public money struggles to do. So, you know, the good city is one which is at ease combining quite a range of different types of money, some of which it will control, some of which it won't, for the greater good. But that requires a certain flexibility and indeed humility on the part of the officials. I think in many parts of the public sector we've seen a shift away from everything being about management, managing housing projects, public transport systems, to mobilization. How do you, alongside management, mobilize multiple stakeholders, alliances, coalitions, again, exactly as you described. It's a very different set of skills and mindsets to classic public administration. And indeed, I think we should probably ban the phrase public administration, which always has exactly the wrong connotations for much of the reality of cities now. And there's then a sort of mindset of doing things fast but small scale with learning, which again is very hard for bureaucracies. And the sort of the bad version of what you described is where cities just get clogged up with permanent consultation. Everyone's always talking to each other in committees, but no one actually does anything. So what's vital, and this is, you know, the spirit of what you were doing, is that you move quickly into action, even if it's quite small-scale action, accepting there's a degree of risk and a degree of uncertainty, but in order then to generate the learning, the energy, the momentum to get things bigger. And I say that's almost precisely opposite to the way many bureaucrats are still trained to perform their roles. So I think in this kind of project is, you know, a really interesting sort of picture of a future truly smart city, which is able to mobilise all sorts of kinds of intelligence to solve its problems. And in a way, I think it's also part of the crucial antidote to a different kind of politics, to authoritarian populism. Because in a way, what these models try to achieve, and you can see this everywhere from Taiwan to Colombia, is how does a community become the hero of its own history? Not just passive observers who are either grateful for what's given to them or angry, but actually have some sense of agency and the difficultness and heroism of themselves trying to solve problems. Now, it's a very interesting moment to have this discussion because you were funded by Michael Bloomberg out of his vast fortune of $50 billion. And as of this week, unlike about a month ago, it is now almost becoming plausible he might become President of the United States. Actually, there's a fair, I would almost bet a bit of money on it now. And it'll be very interesting if he does become president, because obviously he was very much formed by his time as mayor of New York. He is a believer in cities. He is funding, in I think, at least 100 cities across the U.S., you know, to a pretty large extent. And it is, to some extent, he's a bit like, you know, he's a big corporate businessman, but in other senses, he has a sense of what cities can do, which other bits of government can't. And to my mind, this kind of model of the city as platform has to be part of the future. And very finally, I think the heart of what you're describing is a really important point, which I think is often forgotten in universities. And this is an old saying which sums this up, which I think is basically right. The saying is that it's not hope which drives action. It is, as you said, action which drives hope. And so if you are only a sort of passive observer or just watching things or researching them, it's quite easy to become hopeless. It's only through getting stuck into the messy reality of trying to shift things that actually you sense the plasticity of the world and out of that get a sense of hope. And that's why I think it is so important that universities become embedded in the civic life of cities. And actually, British universities and London universities are a lot less embedded than many other cities around the world, which I fear may mean that their faculties become more hopeless than they might be otherwise. Indeed. That's a provocative note. I wish to finish.
We'll take this personally.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks.
So, personally, we can revisit some of Jeff's responses, and specifically the first one, because your presentation and the title of your presentation is forward-looking, right? So it's Sinathina in the 2020s. And the question is, to what extent do you think, Jeff spoke about this latent capacity that cities have, and that a lot of this energy is made explicit at times of crisis. And looking at, economic, cycles, and looking at where there are, troughs in the kind of, economy of the cities, when some of this comes to fruition. And in one sense, when you were presenting your first lines, it reminded me of Berlin in the 1990s, where there was a lot of what people called idleness, both in terms of the human capacity, but also in terms of the spaces. There was a lot of vacancy and latency that was there, for grabbing. And you see this already in Berlin vanishing, very slowly, when you have much more contestation in some of these public spaces, when you have more, formal economic cycles driving decisions. And I wonder to what extent you think, Athens now, because there's so much vibe in the country in terms of its kind of economic pickup, and we have both a mayor and a prime minister that are, traveling the world in terms of, pushing a very good story about, you know, Athens's and Greece's economic return. How do you think this might be kept at, you know, this kind of sustaining some of these efforts?
Well, I think that the problems and the complexity is only growing. We might not call it crisis anymore. It's become a normality, I think. But so the challenges and the complexities of today's, I mean, look at the green, the climate change, all the transformations that municipalities have to do in their services to adapt to that type of strategy. And it's not only technology and even computers and good communication that will solve that, but you need a societal transformation for that. People to change their behavior on their everyday life, and it is. I think I wouldn't call it a service. It is platforms like Synathina give the space for people to explore what they can do, how they can do it, with whom they can do it, open up in that. And it needs a moderator, it needs some coaching. And I think this is what Synathina, unlike other similar platforms that have done a lot and, you know, remarkable other things, I think what we did in that particular moment was this sector of coaching people to be able to articulate, collaborate, open up. I mean, it was one of the most like flattering moments was when some of the very suspicious radical community groups came up to me like at the end, 3 years or 4 years later, saying that, "Oh, I got it. Now I know what you were trying to do. Now I'm, you know, now I want to collaborate with you." So it is this transformation that is incredibly important to be able to. For cities and for communities and societies to adapt to the changes that we will need to be doing to address the problems that are coming, and they are coming, you know.
Presumably
climate change and refugees in Greece will not, you know, those are two big sources.
So when you began the story and how this emerged from your personal, you know, motivation to engage by simply collecting rubbish in your neighborhood, because of a lack of a public service, and you had to kind of, in one sense, fill in for what was not being provided from the kind of, you know, formal, you know, routes. I mean, how do you see this playing now that, you know, municipalities in Athens will have, you know, a reassessment of the public budgets? In one sense, the gaps that are, you know, that were there for civic action might, you know, not necessarily be available. I mean, do you see this as a risk for potentially the project continuing over the next couple of years?
Well, if it's not Synathina, it will be some other one. But I think that that culture has grown. A lot of those community groups have become more formal. They're now NGOs or non-profit organizations. Some a lot have developed in social entrepreneurs. The culture of this bottom-up, let's say, to put it simply, attitude is growing and will be there. And there's always behind the scenes the invisible individual that is coming up with more ideas at the back. And that, of course, has to do with the capacity of the municipality to see the invisible always. At the moment, it is still running on these budgets. So Synathina still exists. It is still in the municipality. They are still implementing the Curing the Limbo project. And I know that the current mayor is interested to go further with it and do some placemaking projects, I think, with it too.
And perhaps I can bring Jeff here. In terms of in the Kypseli public market, you mentioned some of the tensions that existed between the administrators and some of the local groups, you know, working in the space. I mean, how is this tension in terms of what would motivate a local politician to actually engage in this process? And specifically when you have local politicians that, you know, want to have ownership of some of the local services. I mean, at least that's how a lot of politicians that I know in Athens operate. So to what extent did you feel that, you know, they found this as a bit of a threat? And, you know, how do you navigate, you know, around this landscape?
Well, yeah, the resistance was at many levels, as I said, and it was very difficult to to surpass that. I had the way I did it to was that I had the full support of the mayor. I didn't have the full support of his of the people that surrounded him, or the other even vice mayors for that matter. But I had his. He understood exactly what we were doing, and he also knew that there was neither money nor capacity for the municipality to run the bloody place, so that we had to find a solution, and no budget solution. So if it wasn't for his understanding of that particular model, it would have never have occurred. But I wanted to say something else about about the people, you know, the administrators and the city officials. We think of them in a very static way. I mean, some kind of turnover is starting to happen. Some new ones are coming. Something that happened while we were doing all these projects is that for some people, local administration became an incredibly attractive job. It wasn't very well paid, mediocre paid. I mean, we talk about the brain drain. I think that people lack really interesting and creative types of jobs. I mean, I think that type of interest attracts a lot of new people in those positions that can actually find such solutions. You cannot ask from people that are, you know, almost pensioners and burnt out city officials during the crisis, you know, to start innovating, you know. They would look at me with, you know, big eyes and say, you know, I'd love to, but I can't, you know, I can't do this. Mm-hmm. It's not that I am ideologically against it. I just can't do it. Mm-hmm.
And you can see how, you know, of course, some of these initiatives that were full of, you know, social and public purpose, you know, would be very meaningful to sectors of the population that were unemployed or any job offer was...
Exactly. So it is, I think that the job description, the future job description for city officials and administrators, maybe even for politicians, you know, or candidates for the city council, has to show this, you know, what is actually happening in there, which is so thrilling.
Yeah, just a couple of comments. So first of all, on the people, I've seen some examples, including here in London quite a while ago, of moving beyond sort of consultation and so on to creating, giving authority to problem-solving working groups where you bring together perhaps the more established officials, hopefully not too tired, but the younger ones as well, maybe in their 20s, who are more junior, and people from outside the system, and essentially give them a task of designing a way of solving problem X, Y, or Z. Now, with the right mindset and spirit, that can work incredibly well. It mobilizes exactly those energies and excitement, which often the, you know, core administration can't do, and it helps you also find out who really is, you know, a bullshitter, who's actually got good ideas, etc. And it's really sad to me that they're still quite rare, those methods. They're pretty well established, and I've sort of been involved in versions in many, many countries, but they're not standard. And then just the other point is, I think, as Amalia says, I think necessity will drive in this direction, because essentially the biggest challenges for cities of the next 10, 20 years are going to be very hard to deal with the existing models. So maybe to state the obvious, but maybe not. I mean, ageing is the biggest one. In Britain, half of all local authority budgets essentially go on elder care now. And you cannot simply ramp up more and more expensive, paid professional elder care if you don't have ways of mobilizing communities to share a little bit in the responsibility, not just for their family, but also for their neighbors and so on. It will be 100% of all their budgets pretty soon. So the only plausible medium-term sort of future is one which is much more thinking in terms of platform, mobilization, etc. And climate change is even more stark. It's quite easy to picture the Europe's Green Deal announced last month as a very traditional way of badging large-scale investment funds, infrastructure spending, and so on. But there's almost no plausible route to achieving even the Paris Agreement targets, let alone the targets we actually need, just using those methods. You have to mobilize, again, your citizens to experiment, to try new ways of living, new kinds of community energy or transport or, you know, or the circular economy, so people aren't, you know, buying new clothes all the time and throwing it away, or local food sourcing. And all of these things have to be done with a social innovation lens, because you're having to change behaviours and values and attitudes, not just large-scale technical systems. So any mayor who hasn't got that yet is going to be, you know, a pretty going to be a failure, basically. You know, it's both and, not either or. But if you can't complement your sort of European Investment Bank type stuff with this grassroots social innovation, you will simply fail to make the changes fast enough.
I mean, just like, you know, picking up on this, and I mean, the one of the big issues in terms of, and I can't help myself but, you know, respond to today's news of the go ahead of a major railway in this country, HS2, which is a pet passion of our Prime Minister, who's always loved big infrastructure projects, and it seems that this type of bulky projects are the ones that are easier, both from the kind of, you know, the financing perspective, to weigh the risks, and also what might have a lot of, you know, political returns for officials. So when you speak about putting more money on a social research and development and spending more on these small projects, how can we actually achieve this? And also your example of the Green New Deal, for me, it kind of, you know, reverberates of, you know, big infrastructure investments, large mobilizations of capital in new industries. So how do you balance some of the great ideas around the social innovation, which are very, very small scale projects, and scaling them up and comparing them with the, some of these bigger, you know, public spending initiatives?
So did anyone here see Boris Johnson's speech today?
I didn't. I only read the headlines.
Well, it was quite interesting, to the extent these things are actually interesting. So this was his announcement of £106 billion to go on the high-speed railway from London northwards. He felt he had to spend a large chunk of the early part of his speech with an exactly opposite narrative about local bus services. Which was interesting that he felt he couldn't just sell it as this big, shiny, classic infrastructure project, because the politics of that on its own just simply doesn't work in this day and age. And that's a bit of a metaphor. He had to present it first as about lots and lots of small projects solving people's transport needs. Then, of course, all the big money goes on HS2, not on those. Mm. But I think, you know, that there's ways of shaping political narratives which do make the most of multiplying small initiatives. And sometimes you do need very big projects. And I'm quite in favour of Crossrail, which London has been grappling with ever since I can remember. There is some case for high-speed rail, but in my mind, I can think of quite a few other things to do with £100 billion, actually.
Yes.
I suspect it will end up being not... I think there's political payoffs for the announcement moment, but I'm pretty certain almost none of the people involved in it now will get any credit long-term for it.
Yes. Let's think, Amelia, with this subject, about this financing, and it was very clear from your presentation that the way, you know, where this financing came from, specifically from the philanthropies, whether it's Bloomberg or Stavros Niarchos, was instrumental in actually, you know, allowing for this activity to take place. I mean, do you think through the municipal budget route you could get some of these initiatives off the ground as well?
Well, yes, I didn't have the time, but in fact, the last of those projects, called Poly Square, was for the first time municipal budget. And it was a project that what it did was that the municipality rented closed shops and gave it to young creatives for a whole year to revive the streets, the abandoned streets, and also to try out their new startup businesses. So this exchange model. And that was the first time that it cost almost €1 million euro. It was the last of those projects. So yes, so after a lot of experimentation, more than 20 of those projects, at the end, the city council did have, you know, the confidence of doing it. But that money, the city officials of the actual administration or the municipality could not really, did not know how to design this idea of exchanging, you know, closed shops with creative industries. So the money, all that money went to the development agency that implemented it for them. So it has the money. It understands that this is something needed, good for the city, blah, blah. But it cannot do it, which is another big problem.
Mm-hmm. Good. And let me try to squeeze one last question before we open it up to the audience. And this is a potential synergy or attention, and specifically because the project was highlighted by Bloomberg Philanthropies, who've been instrumental in investing in the so-called public innovation sphere, making local government, municipalities more innovative. And it's, you know, to what extent do they support this type of activity in-house? And interestingly, in our executive master's program this year, we have two participants from an initiative in the UK called Public Practice, which tries to embed some of the innovation that exists specifically in the kind of, you know, design industries in local authorities or government entities. And I wonder, I mean, do you see a tension, or is there a synergy between a push for having the city doing the innovation itself internally and driving this with people on its payroll, and, you know, what you're doing, which is kind of more of a kind of, you know, moderating role of supporting some of these, you know, social innovation platforms? Perhaps I'm seeing it too myopically.
I don't exactly understand. I mean, first of all, with Bloomberg Philanthropies, I don't know if you're aware, but they are, together with the OECD, they've been researching in more than 80 or 100 cities around the world the extent to which they innovate and how they innovate and where they get the innovation funding, in what sectors they innovate, etc. Now they're pushing it further to also support these cities to develop a methodology for those that want but don't know how to do it. So, yes, Bloomberg Philanthropies, they have a section which is called Government Innovation. They fund the development of this capacity in city officials and city administrations around the world to implement projects and designs of that kind, if I understand correctly. But you are asking whether, you know, the difference between innovating, city officials taking themselves, you mean the initiative?
And yeah, so the kind of, you know, cities investing in units within the departments that are geared for public sector innovation. A lot of this, and the example that I gave on public practice, is bringing individuals in-house to drive this innovation process.
Well, how do you bring, well, to bring individuals in-house, you have to be hiring. If you're doing austerity measures, and right now in Greece at least, you cannot hire new people. So what is happening is that the actual city officials per se, they are aging and shrinking. So each year they are less and they're older. The younger one, I think at the moment, is 49 years old. So, okay, for those that, from the 12,000 that now they are like 5,000, half of them are actually medically incapable of doing any job. And these are probably remnants of old clientelistic kind of hirings of past decades, yes. Right? They're old and sick, okay? So of those that remain, you know, there is not, I mean, a lot of them realize, completely understand what's happening. They know the job actually incredibly well. And it's very important not to alienate this old generation of fantastic city officials that know the system very well, you know, by, you know, doing, you know, kind of like a smart workshops of innovation, you know. Sorry.
Not on the Greek clientelism, but, you know, on
yeah, but I've worked a lot with lots of these labs and teams, and in fact we did a joint report with Bloomberg many years ago on the ones which were around then, and my bias is that the best ones are all hybrid in some way. They have one foot inside and one foot outside. Now that can be that they work in the system for the mayor, but half their staff are brought in from outside, from universities or startups or community organizations, and then you get the complementarity of the old-timers, you know, who know how the system works, and the newcomers. And if they're 100% outsiders, they'll probably screw up completely. If they're 100% the shrunken old-timers, you know, nothing will happen. So there's a good combination. And sometimes it's better, though, for the entity to be at arm's length organizationally or administratively, partly so it's then easier to take risks and for the mayor to have plausible deniability if some of their risks don't work. Mm. But the key is it has to in some way be hybrid, be half in, half out. If it's completely inside, culturally and in terms of people, it probably won't work. If it's completely outside, it won't be able to mobilize the powers of the city.
Very clear. Okay, let's open this up. We have a good 20 minutes left. I think we have some roving microphones, and perhaps we can take questions in threes.
Hi, I'm Deborah James from Anthropology. I would like to know sort of how much your anthropological background informed some of your activities. Because recently, I think anthropologists have this suspicion, number one, of the state, you know, because many of them are anarchists at heart, but also of capitalism, anything that smacks of neoliberalism, they don't like either. So there's a kind of cynical attitude about notions like innovation, because people think, oh, this is just more neoliberalism in some sort of guise or other. So I just wondered, did you have to strip away that cynical, critical attitude in order to go ahead and do your job? Or how did you draw on your anthropological background?
Thank you. My name is Revati. I'm an urban planner. My question is, firstly, thank you for a very, very inspiring talk, both Jeff and Amalia. I was wondering how this rich experience of community activity can be made relevant to a crisis that we're facing in the UK, particularly in smaller towns, and I refer to the declining high street and town centres. I can understand how people could be motivated to work in communities in their neighbourhoods, but is it a step too far to get them engaged with the high street, or how could those mechanisms work? It's for both of you.
I'm Philip Katsinas from the European Institute here at the LSE. Thank you for the presentation as well. It seems that there's quite some hype about what's going on in Athens and about community involvement and this bottom-up initiatives. But it also seems that there might be a downside to it. Like what you presented seems to have or could potentially have gentrification as a side effect, especially concerning to the regeneration of a market, or the last initiatives that you mentioned of opening up closed doors to creatives. So the question is, who benefits from these activities? Is it really the community? Who is this for? Thank you.
Very clear questions. One more about your anthropological background, to what extent, you know, this has influenced your work, the relevance of this in the UK in terms of, you know, some of the problems we are facing in town centres and declining high streets, and finally, some of the negative externalities, such as gentrification, that might emerge from these initiatives.
Okay. Well, for anthropology, you know, anthropology for me was really the was everywhere in the way I could understand what was happening around me. The main thing I think that kept me thinking of anthropology all the time was the technique of actually going in the field. The municipalities do not have that technique, the anthropological technique of moving themselves into the city. They think that the city will come to them. You know, they have hotlines and that in itself, and it's not only for me, I mean, I know that a lot of municipalities and labs around the world have used anthropologists really to do the field work and find out what exactly people are saying. Because what they say is quite different from what they actually need very often, so you have to read between the lines. So their anthropology, that is the anthropology I'm referring to when I talk about anthropology. Now about the neoliberal thing, the criticism was more the criticism, and it goes also for the other question, was more about the, you know, as I said at the beginning, not wanting to hear any more words about anything. The crisis was, of course, at that extent. I mean, the poverty was visible, the shops were closing, the neighborhoods were being abandoned and being dark. So at that stage, reviving, this is not about development, right? It is making the city roll, making people not be afraid to go to the tube station and go to school for the kids. Of course, one has to be. Very often people ask me that question, and I think that when I say the story, I picture maybe a world that is all good and everybody is nice with each other. And this is a very small portion. I mean, it is one aspect of the reality that is not highlighted enough. I should put it that way. And in Greece in particular, where we love to be very critical of ourselves and say that we are lazy, corrupt, I don't know, it's some kind of, we reproduce that moaning, and I think it serves a lot of things to do that for some reason. I think that it is unfair to hide another side of Greek behavior, which has the reflex, which has this healthy reflex of saying, okay, what can I do about it? And it exists. We don't like to say it. It kind of blurs this negative image we like to have about ourselves. But in fact, it exists. And maybe one should think that if we had to rebuild our identity, to highlight also this side. It's unfair not to. And for the UK question, one thing that I don't know about UK small cities, of course, but our effort was not to spend too much preaching, you know, engagement, but again, go as anthropologists in the field and see what already is happening in the city. I mean, this is the advice for anyone that wants to open up the doors of, you know, finding new individuals and new community activities. See, people constantly do things. They don't name them that way.
Yeah, of course, we don't have any moaning in Britain at all. No. but actually, I think it's quite a serious point. I mean, both on left and right in this country, as many others, and I think social media has massively amplified this kind of subculture of angry moaning detached from action, which is incredibly unhealthy for all the reasons Amalia said and touches everything. So there's a couple of very quick, brief comments. As you said, one of the striking things about these teams and labs and so on around the world is how many of them have ethnographers and anthropologists in them, and the sense that both national and city governments were not previously sufficiently attuned to lived experience, and how different lived experience was from what appeared on the kind of bureaucracy's readings of what was happening. And certainly every time I've worked in government, I've tried to insist that everyone had to go out and visit things, but ideally not as an official, but as a sort of mystery shopper or, you know, sit in on a job. And until you saw things from the bottom up as well as from the top down, that you should believe literally nothing the state says. I mean, that's the rule. That sort of triangulation rule, I think, is really important for any kind of government. Otherwise, you believe your own propaganda. The towns and high street issue, after the financial crisis, there were a lot of very good projects trying to do what you described. So opening up empty shops, even opening up pieces of land for the community to take over. And a number of organisations did this at quite large scale. That worked, I think, quite well in the cities and was relatively temporary in the big cities, because then the economy picked up and sort of normality returned. As you say, for the towns, that hasn't happened. And I'm not really sure what the longer-term version is for town high streets, and that's perhaps a much bigger issue for another time. And then on gentrification, I mean, almost every place you take an old market hall or whatever, and it's been run down and neglected and so on, and you make it lively and dynamic and beautiful,
One of those effects is it makes the neighborhood more attractive. One of those effects is it drives up rents and property prices to some extent, and has some gentrification process, which will have losers as well as winners. But I think that the problem is there is almost no other way of actually reviving or regenerating a city. Everyone always complains about that, and it's happened, you know, every big city in this country and all over Europe. But the question I'd throw back to you is, okay, what's your alternative? I mean, don't expect you to answer that now, but...
Good. Yeah. Let's take another three questions. So the gentleman here first.
Thanks. I'm a superannuated anthropologist now, unemployed. I'd like to know more about how social inequalities, and in particular social class, fits into the story that you've told us. I mean, are all social classes equally involved in the initiatives that you've been describing to us? Do different social classes pursue different agendas when you're deciding what it is, what agenda you're going to follow? I just didn't get much impression of social differentiation in relation to your very interesting program.
Thank you. Hi, I'm Lara Kinnear. I am a believer and provoker of good governance. I've got various hats, which I won't go through. I was really interested in where you left off your conversation about people in the system. And having worked in governance and private sector, I know that when you put people in the system, they can get battered and bruised very easily, and they need the oxygen every so often to kind of survive and keep fighting. So how can we make sure that it's not just people that are trying to change, but how can we use tools to change the system a bit better? And with the new fashion of social purpose, is that a tool that we can use, or is that something that we can run with at the minute to try and deliver a bit more change than sometimes people can do by themselves? Yeah, if you like public practice, which I'm very familiar with, you know, they go in and they are new thinkers in an old system, and that's always, it's good and they can achieve a lot, but they often have to retreat and gain more oxygen and gain more inspiration and then go back in. And I'm thinking that, okay, that's one approach, but how can we ensure that we're doing more than that? Because it does require some system change.
Thank you very much for a great discussion. So I'm Kira, I'm a PhD student at the European Institute. And so thinking in terms of scaling up, right? So how do we scale up this kind of efforts into something, I don't know, perhaps bigger for the 2020s. You mentioned two kinds of institutions that I think are very clear in a way to explain abstractly, right? So you create local arenas for discussion and conflict resolution, you bring people together, and in a sense you also, like, you subsidize the efforts, the kind of collective innovative effort, right? You provide, I don't know, the empty shop, etc. It's a form of, I don't know, reducing seed funding, I don't know. Didn't you also have a method of kind of helping people enforce the kind of rules of good behavior, or protect the goods that they were creating from antisocial behavior of others? Like, how did you manage this kind of thing where, for example, I don't know, you have a group creating something great in one of the schools and then one person comes and somehow ruins it? Like, how did groups protect the goods they created from antisocial behavior, and did the city help them in any way to do that?
Okay, I will start with Jonathan Parry. I was laughing because you were the one that interviewed me, and that's how I got into LSC social anthropology. And you made a similar question about class, which I thought I had badly answered, but finally you got me in. So the range, the people that were involved in this have come from a really wide range, from the most radical anarchists, marginal to more entrepreneurial, at least throughout those last 5 years where I watched. The ages ranged a lot between 25 and 35, but also older people, 50 plus, would be part of those. I mean, the age range was such. The character of the activities differed a lot according to where they stand in that range. There was a lot of activities that had to do with food, soup kitchens, solidarity type of activities were usually more militant, let's say, had more of a militant character, whereas other type, more designer-like activities, like redesigning urban furniture and urban infrastructure, would come from probably more educated people that had finished universities, young architects, designers, unemployed at the time. If that answers the questions a little bit. But we never made, and it's worth actually doing, a more consistent research on the background and character of those activity groups. About the burning out, if I understand it correctly. Rotation, as you say, is one way of answering and addressing that dead end of people having to come out of the system and back again. One very important thing is not to alienate, as I said earlier, the people that know the old system. I think that is incredibly important, to give them a role in this transformation. Transformation is happening whether we like it or not. It is very important to keep them on board. They know enormous things, and usually in administrations also they are nobody says anything to them. I mean, they're never awarded for it or encouraged for it. I don't know if I answer it, but that's it. About the practices and... Well, we had the instance of soup kitchens by Golden Dawn, which was the extreme right wing party that wanted to feed only Greeks, not foreigners, and of course that was banned. But there is, you are right in asking, how do you evaluate these activities? And of course, How do you evaluate those that have real positive social impact? As we said, we tried to create templates of evaluation. You know, do people really come to these activities? Do they benefit from them? How many benefit from them? How are they handled? The open schools that had to do with spaces where school children come in the morning, we had to have people really to be there every day and moderate that. Just to say something about evaluation, some of the spontaneous activities like pop-up festivals or music, jamming music in the middle of the squares, one time the mayor told me, he said, don't let these guys, they're messing up public space, they leave their garbage back, don't let them do their stuff. And I disagreed with him, saying that it's so important for people to feel that they own the city. So it doesn't matter if some of those activities are sloppy, clumsy, not with high social impact. It is important to let people have the experience of being part of this. And he agreed.
Well, just two comments. So one on really the class question. If a city sort of opens itself up and says anyone can come up with ideas and proposals and so on, you're bound to get an incredibly uneven response by class, by age, by gender, by race. At first, you will tend to get, in most cities, the young, educated, confident will be much more much quicker to respond to those opportunities, even though probably the older and poorer will actually have more underlying motivation in their lives to get things fixed. So this has been a big issue in many cities. Barcelona, for example, under Ada Colau, really prioritised using meetings, community activism and so on to get the inputs roughly reflecting the social makeup of the city.
Others, like in fact Bloomberg's New York, it was very, very skewed to the young, educated, middle class. I think this is a particular problem in Britain because of the weakening of working class organisation the last 20 or 30 years, the decay of the trade unions, the Labour Party essentially becoming a middle class party. It's one of the reasons for new initiatives, well, now quite old ones, like Uprising, which I was involved in, trying to train up new cadres of activists from working class backgrounds. But if you don't address some of that, then you will tend to get, a sort of skewed input. The other problem which we've had in this country, I don't know, maybe it's a question for you, is with community centres, with physical centres, often get to reflect the community as it is at a particular moment. And then, certainly in cities like this, with high churn, it may well be the ethnic makeup, or even class makeup of the area is completely different 20 years ago. But, as it were, the committee, the board of the community centre is sort of like history is frozen. And that creates all sorts of tensions in fast-changing societies where their community is not a static concept. So yeah. How do you deal with that one?
Community centres, I mean, the old type of associations that we had in Athens kind of got stuck, and during the years of that rising activity, they slowly joined in wherever they could. I don't know how to answer your question actually for Athens. But what I would like to add is that a lot of those activities became also a way, as I said earlier, to integrate refugees. It was very interesting to see how those activities could become ways to develop skills for refugees in order for them to find jobs. So that is also another aspect of that.
Thank you. We have unfortunately run out of time, but we've spoken a lot about latency this evening and who has the latency. Amalia told me earlier that she has quite a bit of latency this year in her visiting position within LSECP. So if you want to engage in some of her work or are open for collaborations in terms of some of the work that you're doing in your cities, please approach Amalia.
Okay.
But I'd like to thank the LSE stewards, Emily Cruz and Jennifer Ho, for making tonight possible. And of course, our speakers, Amalia Zeppu and Jeff Morgan. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.